This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's like a screenplay from a really bad disaster movie, a collapse in consumer demand, a coordinated worldwide recession. And now people are talking about a global pandemic? I mean, come on. The economics of swine flu today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear conversations with poets about the economy, music, cooking, and more at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the studios of KUHF in Houston, Texas, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, 27th of April. Great to have you with us. It is important to set the terms of the debate here. Nobody has actually said there is a pandemic or even what the Centers for Disease Control calls a major outbreak. Still, swine flu has gotten everybody's attention, and nowhere more than in Mexico. Experts say a rapid global response could head off an epidemic, but the country that is so far at the center of it all worries any cure could wind up doing harm. From the America's Desk at WLRN in Miami, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more now on what's ailing the Mexican economy.
Mexico's already dealing with a violent drug war, a drop in remittances from workers overseas, and a deepening recession. Now there's the swine flu. Mexicans are wearing surgical masks and watching the national pastime on TV.
Mexico City, the soccer matches, there was nobody in the stands.
That's Joan Nichols with the Galveston National Biocontainment Laboratory. She says it's too early to say whether the flu will blow up worldwide or blow over. As long as that uncertainty exists, the European Union has told its citizens to avoid traveling to Mexico and the U.S.
There's a major economic impact, but I'd rather make decisions based on having too stringent a shutdown that we didn't need rather than having been too lax and it was necessary.
China and Russia have banned pork from much of North America, even though the virus is not spread by food. As for Mexico, its tourism industry was already struggling with bad press surrounding drug violence. George Grayson is a professor at the College of William and Mary in Virginia.
The outbreak of the influenza has certainly further delivered a body blow to people who are thinking about visiting Mexico or honeymooning there.
Visitors to Mexico City over the weekend dropped by an estimated 20%, and that could be just the beginning. The U.S. today issued a travel advisory asking Americans to avoid non-essential visits to Mexico. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
It's being called a tentative agreement. Members aren't going to vote on it until Wednesday, but it looks like Chrysler and the United Auto Workers have struck a deal that should pad the carmaker's balance sheet with more government cash. It would also mean Chrysler can pay less into a new health fund for retirees. Workers at General Motors and Ford are going to be watching closely because auto workers' benefits have been the envy of the American labor force for years. We asked Ashley Milne-Tite to explain how benefits at Chrysler and General Motors might appear after the negotiating's all said and done.
Healthcare benefits are the jewel in the crown of auto workers' retirement plans. Harley Shaken is an expert in labor studies at the University of California, Berkeley. He says traditionally, auto workers have been guaranteed health benefits.
In full until your death, there were, of course, some co-pays, but by and large, the company took care of your retirement and your health care once you left active employment after 3 decades in the industry.
He says health care benefits will probably suffer in crisis agreement with the UAW. Edward Lapham is executive editor of Automotive News. He says the White House wants to see workers protected in their retirement.
Actually, the benefits probably won't be radically reduced. The UAW, of course, was a big supporter of the president in the last election.
After this year, none of the big three will be directly responsible for paying retiree healthcare benefits. They'll be paid by a trust administered by the union. Chrysler contributed $9 billion to the trust, but Harley Shaken says under this new agreement with the UAW,
half of the $9 billion that Chrysler committed in 2007 will now be funded in Chrysler stock. And with a bankruptcy proceeding on top of that, there are a lot of question marks.
If Chrysler recovers and its stock does well, that'll boost the amount of money in the fund. But if the stock collapses or is wiped out in bankruptcy, the fund could be $4.5 billion poorer. And retirees could find that jewel in the crown is worth far less than they thought. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
In Hollywood today, there is talk of another big deal. The mega talent agencies William Morris and Endeavor are expected to announce a get-together. A deal could create a star chamber big enough to let agents take back some of their power from the industry's big studios. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
First, the players. The William Morris agency started more than a century ago. Endeavor is more of an upstart. Together, the two would have 300 agents, $300 million in revenue, and clout.
The leverage that the stars and, in particular, the agents have had have been substantially eroded by just the sheer weight of the recession.
That's entertainment industry analyst Larry Gerbrand. He says in the past, agencies have called the shots on projects, salaries, and scripts. But these days, the big movie studios make the deals. The merger would bring together lots of star power under one roof. Travolta, De Niro, Kate Hudson.
It makes far less sense to constantly compete against each other for clients and for projects.
So long as the agency's cultures don't clash, the head of Endeavor, Ari Emanuel, is the model for Ari Gold, the abrasive agent on HBO's Entourage.
I'm going to take everyone, your B-level sitcom stars, your reality TV writers. When I'm done with you, you're going to be repping Sideshow Freaks.
Nelson Gayton teaches entertainment management at UCLA.
If Ari Emanuel is representative of the culture of Endeavor, will Endeavor as an organization fit with the culture of William Morris?
You can be sure Hollywood will be watching. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, not swine flu, just a case of the chills. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. GM's decision to pull Pontiac off the market that was confirmed today still leaves them plenty of models to sell. Even if it shuts down or sells off Saturn, Saab, and Hummer, GM is going to have 4 brands and 34 different models. Still, some analysts think GM should streamline even more. Commentator David Kiley gets where they're coming from, but he says dumping Pontiac goes far enough.
In the parlance of corporate restructuring, GM is aiming to get lean and mean. Assuming it stays in business, these cutbacks would leave the company with Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick, and GMC trucks. But is 4 brands still too many? After all, GM's fiercest competitor, Toyota, does better with just 3 brands now. So, no surprise, some are questioning whether GM has cut enough. Does it really need Buick and GMC? I mean, who's really buying these brands anyway? Don't ask me why, but Buick is big in China. It's like how Jerry Lewis is huge in France. No one knows why, it just is. And the theory goes that if GM kills Buick in the US, the Chinese will want it less. And China figures big in GM's future. GMC is another story. New ads for GMC are pitching the brand, and I'm not kidding here, as the unofficial truck of America's infrastructure rebuilding. I used to work in the ad business. I never thought I would see the word infrastructure in TV ad copy. Since GMC trucks and SUVs are really just Chevrolets with different paint colors and the GMC logo, what's the point? But so help me, there are a couple of 100,000 consumers a year who, if you took GMC away, would not buy the same truck with the Chevy nameplate. They'd go to Ford, Dodge, or Toyota. So the four-brand strategy at GM seems right to me. The important thing is this. These four parasite brands GM is cutting only hold about 3% of the market, but they're finally leaving the host body. What GM has been trying to do for too long is spread its limited marketing and management attention across too many brands. It's been the equivalent of trying to stretch rations for four people to feed eight in a lifeboat. The result is malnourishment, sickness, and eventual death for all. In other words, what you have at GM right now.
David Kiley is the senior Detroit correspondent for Business Week magazine. We invite your thoughts on this or anything else you hear on the broadcast. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. With all the concern about health in the headlines, here is some reassuring news. Lawmakers want to tighten up on drugs coming here from overseas. The Senate is considering a bill to let the Food and Drug Administration keep more drugs out and at the same time to step up the inspections it already does in foreign countries. It hasn't really been that long since the FDA first opened field offices in places like China and India, but some there are already complaining of a witch hunt. Raymond Thibodeau reports now from New Delhi.
The FDA's inspectors have already raised safety concerns and banned at least four big Indian drug companies from exporting some of their products to the U.S., blocking about 30 products from Ranbaxy Pharmaceuticals, India's biggest pharma company. It prevented sales of Ranbaxy's generic versions of the antibiotic Cipro and the cholesterol pill Zocor. Ranbaxy declined an on-air interview, but in an email response it said the FDA ban resulted from concerns about just two of its five plants in India.
The FDA has said it has no evidence the drugs on the market are substandard and also that they comply with specifications upon testing. Ranbaxy will continue to cooperate with the FDA.
The company also says it will issue responses to FDA's concerns as appropriate. But some Indian business groups see the FDA's actions as outright protectionism, brought about by the lobbying of big American drug companies at a time when the U.S. economy is at a downturn.
Naturally, in that case, you will try to find out ways to restrict imports.
A.J. Sahai is executive director of the Federation of Indian Export Organizations.
In many of the cases, Indian companies do have a case where they have been stopped by the large companies present in the importing countries. They tried to restrict the import at whatever cost, for citing whatever reason.
At the FDA's headquarters in Maryland, officials deny that accusation. Dr. Murray Lumpkin is the deputy commissioner of the FDA's Office of International Programs.
We really, as a regulatory agency, don't care where the products come from. It simply matters that they indeed are able to show us that they meet our standards for safety, quality, and efficacy. And those standards are the same whether it's New Jersey or New Delhi.
India's government has vowed to take up the issue of protectionism with the U.S., but American public concern over tainted drug imports remains high, and the FDA's overseas expansion will continue. The agency has plans for field offices in Latin America, the Middle East, and Africa. It says this should speed up the approval process, get foreign drugs into U.S. stores sooner, and bring down prices for American consumers. In New Delhi, I'm Raymond Thibodeau for Marketplace.
Historical tourism is what you might call a specialty in Philadelphia. That's one reason city officials are trying to get rid of tour guides who mix a little fiction with their fact. They've passed a new licensing law to try to safeguard the historical record. But some of the guides themselves say Philadelphia needs its own history lesson in the Bill of Rights. Joel Rose reports.
When tourists come to Independence Hall, they often turn to professional tour guides with questions about the city's history.
What years was Philadelphia the capital?
Well, from 1790 to 1800. Both George Washington and John Adams lived in Philadelphia during their presidencies.
A lot of tour guides, including this horse and buggy driver, know their stuff, but some don't. And that's what bothers Ron Avery. He's a former newspaper reporter who's become a sort of unofficial watchdog for local tour guides.
There's myths that nobody ever examines. They just repeat them.
and because it's been repeated for years, therefore it must be true.
Avery says he once heard a guide point out the spot where George Washington and Abraham Lincoln ate lunch together. Blatant fabrications like that one prompted a new law requiring tour guides to take a 2-hour history test. But some Philadelphia tour guides say the law ignores one important historical precedent, the First Amendment.
The city government has essentially said that they need to have the power to fine people up to $300 for engaging in unauthorized talking. There is nothing less American than a fine for unauthorized talking.
Lawyer Robert McNamara from the Libertarian Institute for Justice argued his case Friday on behalf of three plaintiffs, including longtime tour guide Anne Boulay. She says the new law wouldn't really help.
We're talking history, but we're also being entertainers. Just because I can pass a test doesn't make me a good tour guide.
But city officials insist the new law does not violate anyone's First Amendment rights because it only requires a one-time test without any ongoing supervision. History buff Ron Avery agrees.
As a guide, you have total freedom of speech. No one will ever find you, arrest you, follow you around, marking down your mistakes.
A ruling is expected in the coming months. If the courts toss out Philadelphia's licensing law, similar rules in Washington, D.C., New Orleans, and elsewhere could be vulnerable. In Philadelphia, I'm Joel Rose for Marketplace.
Coming up, paying big for CEO perks.
I don't really have a problem when the companies are doing this for business travel. You know, it's a pain in the neck to fly. But $1.1 million in personal, you know, travel really calls into question where is the board of directors.
But first, let's do the numbers. Worries that the swine flu outbreak could intensify help send stocks lower today. The Dow Industrial shed 51 points, about 0.6%, closed at 8,025. The NASDAQ dropped 14 points, 0.8%, finished at 1679. The S&P 500 slid 8 points, just over 1%, ended the day at 857. Airline shares had an especially turbulent day. United Airlines coasted more than 14% lower. Continental throttled back about 16%. Concerns over a possible drop in gasoline demand this summer hurt petroleum stocks. Chevron decelerated nearly 2%. Its rival ExxonMobil slipped 0.6%. The swine flu wasn't all bad news on Wall Street. Shares of Gilead Sciences, developer of the blockbuster flu drug Tamiflu, rose more than 3.5%. Roche, which distributes Tamiflu, closed 4.5% higher overseas. Meanwhile, GlaxoSmithKline, which markets rival drug Relenza, finished the day more than 7.5% higher. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.9%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor. Online at finrafoundation.org. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
The solution to Boston.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Last year, there were 1,215 foreclosed properties in the city of Boston. It's a lot of people losing their homes, but it didn't break local records, as foreclosures in a lot of other places around the country have. From WBUR, Monica Brady-Myrov has more now on how Boston has managed to stay on top of the foreclosure crisis.
The solution to Boston's foreclosure crisis is on Hendry Street. The street is in the crosshairs of the city's foreclosure intervention team. The quick response program brought in police to deter crime, filled potholes on the street, and cleaned up public spaces. The mayor's housing advisor is Pat Canavan.
The mayor has directed us to look to where we can eradicate the blight that's caused by these foreclosed properties. So that gets us into a strategy that sometimes seems street by street. But that's how this crisis is working out. It is street by street.
The Dorchester neighborhood has lots of streets with foreclosures. Hendry Street had four houses boarded up just a year ago. Today, three are being rehabilitated. Canavan walks into a building with three apartments under construction.
And pretty soon, this property and several others will be on the market, and we hope to have home buyers living in here again and bringing this neighborhood back to be a decent place to live.
Boston has almost 1,000 foreclosures, but that's only half the number in cities the same size, such as Washington, D.C. The reason why Boston is faring better is that the economy hasn't sunk as far as fast here as in other cities. And Boston's mayor saw the problem coming. Evelyn Friedman heads the city's neighborhood development program.
The mayor, he recognized this problem very, very early, and he started all these campaigns that prevented people from getting bad loans in the first place.
But many people did sign bad loans, so the city is also funding programs to save homes from foreclosure. Lily Searcy heads a nonprofit housing group in Boston.
The city of Boston has been extremely proactive, helping homeowners to plan in advance. If you know that you're at risk of losing your home, that you spend more time working with the lenders so that they don't lose their home.
Over the past 2 years, the city has lowered its foreclosure rate by 20%. But that still leaves hundreds of homes vacant, boarded up, and ripe for vandalism. Because of this, the city has put a moratorium on all new housing developments.
Because there's no point.
Again, city official Evelyn Friedman.
I mean, we have so many properties in the neighborhoods. Why build new when we have plenty of properties that we can get people to buy?
And that's the point, to get people back into foreclosed properties. It's one part of a multi-layered approach to the foreclosure crisis in Boston that seems to be working. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady Meyerov for Marketplace.
The New York Times had one of those pieces this weekend that just kind of make you stop and say, wait, what? It seems the folks who work on Wall Street are set to earn just about as much this year as they did before the economy went south. The paper says thanks to the strong first quarter they had, six big banks have set aside more than $36 billion to pay their employees. But paychecks and bonuses are only part of the compensation package for a lot of CEOs on Wall Street. Many of them get some really nifty perks, too. We've called Michelle Leader for help combing through the fine print of all those employment contracts. She runs footnoted.org. That's a website that explores the fine print full time. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
You'd have to think, wouldn't you, that in this day and age, given what's going on out there, that the perks that CEOs are getting would be, well, if not frowned upon, then somewhat more rare. But really, that's not the case.
Not at all.
Well, so what are you finding?
Oh, well, the former chairman and CEO of Time Warner, for example, you know, he left as CEO about a year ago, and then he left as chairman at the end of the year. But, you know, when he left, part of his employment contract was that he got an office, $776,000 to furnish an office for 1 year. Now, that makes for a really, really nice office, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's right. And there's, I mean, there's corporate travel, there's the jet, there's all these things that these guys get, right?
There's, you know, the CEO of J.Crew, he now has a helicopter at his disposal because the corporate jet isn't enough. You know, I was joking around about it that he's mimicking the first family in the sense that they have a helicopter, he has a helicopter now. J.Crew is a big company that the Obamas like to wear.
That's right, that's right.
You know, it's like the biggest fan.
Yeah. Don't these companies, though, have boards of directors whose job it is to keep an eye on these kinds of things?
They do have boards of directors. And so you have to wonder, why are these boards still giving away the store, particularly when the companies are not performing very well? I mean, Abercrombie & Fitch, for example, their CEO spent $1.1 million on, you know, personal use of the corporate jet. We're not talking about business meetings. I don't really have a problem when the companies are doing this for business travel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a pain in the neck to fly. But $1.1 million in personal, you know, travel really calls into question, where is the board of directors and what are they doing?
Why is it important, though, that individual investors know about this? If I've got 20 shares of J.Crew, it's really not that big a deal that the guy's got a helicopter.
If you have 20 shares of J.Crew, you probably don't care about this and you probably shouldn't be, you know, paying attention to this. But if you have 1,000 shares or, you know, significant position in J.Crew, then this is something that you do want to pay attention to because it reflects often on the performance of the company.
In the much larger sense, right?
In the much larger sense, yeah. I mean, one has to ask the question. I mean, if you look at the, you know, the CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch, I mean, that stock was down 70-something percent last year. The CEO's air traffic usage, personal use of the corporate jet, I should say, was up dramatically. It was up about 60% last year. maybe he should be paying a little bit more attention on what's going on at the stores instead of, you know, flying around to wherever he's flying around for personal use of the corporate jet.
Well, where is the disclosure, though? I mean, is it really buried in the footnotes, and don't the boards have an easier way to find out?
Well, you would think that the board would have a chance to see this information, you know, at a board meeting. But yes, it is buried deeply in the footnotes. It's often a footnote to something called the summary compensation table. And then from there, there's additional footnotes in there. So it's not something that you're going to be doing on a casual Saturday, like, hey, let me read through a proxy statement and read the footnotes.
Yeah, unlike you, right?
Unlike me, who spends a little bit too much time reading the footnotes.
Michelle Lehner runs the website footnoted.org. She blogs at the New York Times as well. She's got a Perks Watch column there. Michelle, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
To mark April being National Poetry Month, we're spending a couple of Mondays on the poetry of all things economic. A lot of you wrote to nominate Smart by Shel Silverstein, a poem about kids and money. So for some analysis, we took it to the source, Ms. Sims' 4th, 5th, and 6th graders in Fullerton, California. They caught on pretty quickly that the hero's not exactly the best with money.
Because he gets less and less money when he thinks he's getting more.
He had $1 and now he only has 5 cents.
Here's the whole thing, Ms. Sims' kids reading Smart from Shel Silverstein's Where the Sidewalk Ends.
Smart. My dad gave me $1 bill because I'm his smartest son. And I swapped it for 2 shiny quarters because 2 is more than 1.
And then I took the quarters and traded them to Lou. For 3 dimes, I guess he didn't know that 3 was more than 2.
Just then along came old blind Bates. And just because he can't see, he gave me 4 nickels for my 3 dimes. And 4 is more than 3.
And then I took the nickels to Hiram Combs down at the seed feed store, and the fool gave me 5 pennies for them, and 5 is more than 4.
And then I went and showed my dad, and he got red in the cheeks, and closed his eyes and shook his head, too proud of me to speak.
From the mouths of 10-year-olds, bigger is not always better. That was Sarah Nascimento, Vadi Egdarafi, Victoria Vo, Simone Brandt, Kevin Chow, and the rest of Ms. Sims' class at Arborland Montessori School in Fullerton, California. Next week, 3 poems about one thing, work. You can find the rest of our poetry series at our homepage. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap in marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
This final note today, a farewell to Pontiac on the day the General Motors officially pulled the plug. From the website Jalopnik.com, the 10 greatest Pontiac models ever. I'll pass on reading you the whole list, but here are the highlights such as they are. The Bonneville is on there, the GTO, of course, the Trans Am. Somehow the Fiero made it on there. I don't quite understand that one. For me, though, GM was a goner the day it killed Oldsmobile 4 or 5 years ago. First car I ever had was a 1971 Cutlass convertible. It was red. Had a white top, went really, really fast. And yeah, I still miss it. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 51 points, about 0.6%. The NASDAQ dropped 14 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 slipped down 8 points, just over 1% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Special thanks today to the staff here at KUHF in Houston. Coming up next time on the program, back home in Los Angeles, tracking growth in a new market.
If you're selling to people who are eco-minded, earth-friendly, it's a natural product, and they jump on it. If you're with people who, for some reason, have a negative fetish towards hair, then no matter what you do, they're not going to get over it.
Probably not. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.